Normally, this wouldn't be hard to manage. It was his default state of being, after all. But since the meeting in the conference room, his world had been knocked off kilter, and he could do little more than sit quietly with a distracted gaze on his face. At lunch, the talk in the dining room had been, not surprisingly, on the data breach. Ethan remained quiet while most of the rest of his colleagues speculated that some IT geek had accessed the files and then covered it up, either because he'd screwed up in the first place or, just maybe, because he was spooking for a foreign power. Ethan's only comment on the subject was a hope that his poly didn't interfere with either the staff meeting in the West Wing on Wednesday afternoon or his appointment to get his teeth cleaned on Thursday afternoon. He forced out the words, knowing he'd look guilty as hell if he didn't bitch about the intrusion along with everyone else. He'd attended a director's meeting just after lunch, and he'd strolled with other staffers to a conference room on the north side of the Eisenhower building, their voices echoing up the ornate marble corridor as the topic of conversation remained on the investigation. At the meeting, there was more small talk about what most of the staff saw as the FBI's heavy-handed encroachment on the NSC. But Ethan said little. He only thumbed through pages of a briefing booklet he'd been working on, and did his best not to show any signs of concern. By mid-afternoon, he was back at his desk. In front of him was a printout of a letter he'd written, requisitioning a paper on popular opinion in Jordan of the new U.S. ambassador. It was something to get his mind off his situation. Busy work. Except it wasn't working. Every time someone passed his office, he felt a tightening in his stomach, and his hands, already dry and papery, burned at the palms. He had visions of G's like that Albright character he'd seen marching into his office, storming around his desk, and telling him to stand up and put his hands behind his back. Ethan felt nauseated about the possibility his breach could be uncovered. But more than this, he was disoriented. He knew he had done everything right. His breach should have gone undetected. What the hell went wrong? It is said there are four major motivations for committing espionage, and in the intelligence realm, the collective is abbreviated as MICE. Money, ideology, compromise, ego. In Ethan's case, money and compromise were not relevant. His mother was wealthy, and she shared her largesse with her adult son, and Ethan had no real skeletons in his closet that could have led to his being compromised. Instead, his motives could be best characterized as a combination of one part ideology and four parts ego. To those very few who really knew him, this would come as no great surprise, because Ethan Ross was somewhat opinionated, but he was most definitely a narcissist, and if these predilections were built into him by nature, his nurture certainly did nothing to help him overcome them. Ethan's parents, like all parents everywhere, were convinced their child was brilliant and special. Unlike most parents, their conviction was confirmed by outsiders when, at the age of 4, young Ethan earned a very superior classification on the Stanford-Binet Intelligence Scale IQ test. After this verification of his excellence, he became the family prodigy and was forever after treated as such. He was placed in the best schools, tutored in math and science and language, and told regularly that he'd have a future not just of importance, but of power as well. Ethan grew up like a member of royalty, living first among socialist Europe's upper class when his parents were in government and education abroad, then as the child of tenured professors in academia here in the U.S. His parents' core political beliefs in the strength, power, and certitude of U.N. resolutions, multinational peace treaties, and international law ensured that Ethan was brought up with the conviction that a benevolent governing class should rule over those incapable of making decisions for themselves. and Ethan was raised as an heir apparent to this ruling class. He thought nothing of the fact both the vice president of France and one of the Belgian princesses were close family friends. He skied in Zermatt and beached in Monaco, and the home in Georgetown Heights, where he spent his teenage years, was in the same cul-de-sac as homes owned by a senator, three ambassadors, a Pulitzer-winning playwright, and one of the best-known national television anchors. Even before he left home to pursue an Ivy League education, he was introduced to world leaders at parties as a future Secretary of State, or even as a future president, and Ethan Ross grew into manhood, believing his own hype. At Yale, he studied with an eye toward the family business, diplomacy, so he majored in international affairs. But like many his age, he'd developed a passion for computers as a teen, and his keen intellect advanced his love for technology to a level far beyond most. He sought a minor in computer science at Yale, much to the chagrin of his parents. They thought it pedestrian of him to spend so much time with his head in the minutiae of computers instead of on the big macro issues that would lead to the betterment of society. His father called computer scientists nothing more than glorified blue-collar workers. His mother treated his obsession as a fad and a fancy, as if he were spending his time playing Grand Theft Auto instead of what he actually was doing, learning Linux-based programming and developing his own software. But he did well at Yale in both of his chosen disciplines, and then, to his parents' everlasting relief, he attended Harvard's Kennedy School to focus exclusively on statecraft. After university, he took a job with the Department of State in the Foreign Service. He spent the bulk of his 20s in consular affairs, but where most Foreign Service officers had to do their time in the lower rung of consular postings like Djibouti, Haiti, or El Salvador, Ethan Ross's family pedigree and a few calls from senators who were good friends of Mom and Dad steered him away from the hardship areas, and instead his three foreign postings were at three of the diplomatic corps' most sought-after locations, Vienna, Amsterdam, and Paris. At age 28, he left state to work in the Democratic Presidential Administration as a junior foreign policy advisor. Soon he had his eye on a position under the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, but the job prospect fell through, so he moved laterally from the White House into the National Security Council to get some practical training under his belt before taking the next high-ranking United Nations post that came along. But his career path hit speed bumps when his personality clashed with both hawkish NSC staffers with military backgrounds as well as members of the new Republican administration in power. And with his darkening prospects came the darkening mood common with those who feel their work beneath their abilities and their talents unappreciated. Staffers he considered inferior took plum UN postings, while Ethan stayed at his desk in the Eisenhower building, watching life pass him by. By his early 30s, Ethan's narcissism was on full display. His self-confidence had morphed into cockiness, and then finally what a few in his department considered unbridled arrogance. By his third year in his position at NSC, he had become indignant about what he considered his small role in the U.S. diplomatic realm, and this, partnered with his feelings of superiority, made his working relationship with many of his colleagues particularly icy. All that said, no one had any suspicions he was responsible for passing secrets. Ethan Ross's first foray into the nebulous world of intelligence trafficking began above board when he was selected by the deputy director for the Middle East region to pass a small piece of information on background to an acquaintance, a reporter at Politico. Authorized government leaks are a common tool in statecraft. Officials speaking on background to a friendly reporter often relay an item of coveted information, careful to secure a promise from the reporter that he or she understands no attribution should go along with the nugget. Ethan's leaked item to Politico made the paper the next day. It wasn't interesting enough to extend beyond the Beltway or even outside the conference rooms around downtown D.C. and Foggy Bottom, but he appreciated the laser-like impact of the well-timed chat with a compliant member of the Fourth Estate. After this successful tip-off to his Politico acquaintance, he was used by NSC staff on other occasions to pass further items of interest, most of which amounted to little more than gossip. But Ethan began to get a taste for it, a feel for how to leverage secure information for low-risk impact, and a hunger for the feeling of power that came from pushing policy through his own actions. It was his ego, ultimately, that convinced him he didn't really need supervisory approval for his disclosures. He was more than competent to make the decision about what to spill himself. And it was his ideology that gave him the desire to drop specific bits of intelligence to the media. He believed U.S. foreign policy had become too meddlesome and overbearing since the new administration had come to power. He saw too many violations of international law under the guise of national security, too many American soldiers and spies working together with too many foreign soldiers and spies. The institutions he truly believed in, the International Court of Justice, the United Nations, and other large world institutions, could never flourish as long as world powers like America continued to act in the shadows to tip the scales in their own favor. Ethan had the means and the motive to make small gestures to combat such imperial overreach, but he knew he could no longer use the reporter at Politico for unauthorized disclosures, because it would be only a matter of time before Ethan was outed as the conduit of the intelligence. He needed to find himself a new cutout. He first learned of the International Transparency Project after reading an article translated from Der Spiegel. The German magazine produced a series of investigative reports into the U.S. military-industrial complex and its purchase of weapons of war from German companies such as Diehl BGT Defense and Atlas Elektronik. Using confidential memoranda from inside the companies, Der Spiegel revealed precise budgets, specific weapons capabilities, and exact delivery dates. As evidence, they showed the leaked emails between the defense contractors and the U.S. Department of Defense. The ITP was credited in the article for finding and then protecting the whistleblower who passed the intelligence to Der Spiegel, though ITP made no formal announcement itself. This was but one of many gets attributed to the ITP over the next few months, and the more Ethan looked into them, the more he liked what he saw. He was fascinated by the anonymous nature of the organization and the impressive list of successes ascribed to them, though he was skeptical at first of the claims that the organization kept whistleblowers safe through encryption that even the American National Security Agency could not hack. Still, Ethan had to admit, the project seemed to be getting things done. He learned more about the ITP in an award-winning documentary film with the sanctimonious title The Future of Truth. The movie portrayed the loose consortium of whistleblowers, investigative journalists, and ethical hackers. The film used the laudatory term hacktivists, as a group of citizen world police, a league of idealists who were the last line of defense between corrupt national governments and the common man. Around this time, Ross was in Berlin for a NATO conference, and he saw, just by chance, that the director and producer of The Future of Truth would be speaking at the nearby Berlinische Galerie about her film. On the spur of the moment, Ethan walked over to the event. As an American government employee with TS security clearance, this could have raised a red flag had anyone known about it, but he simply bought a ticket to the gallery and slipped into the back of the room as the filmmaker gave her presentation. The director's name was Gianna Bertoli. She was a 45-year-old Swiss who'd learned filmmaking at UC Berkeley and spoke perfect English. She talked at length about the ITP, fawning over both the integrity and the technical prowess of the organization. The one skeptical reporter in the room asked her about rumors of foreign sponsorship of the group, but Bertoli dismissed the allegation out of hand, saying in the year she spent researching and filming her documentary, she never once caught even a hint the project was anything more than a well-meaning cadre of egalitarians who were sponsored by wealthy progressives, mostly in the United States and Europe. Ethan was as impressed with Bertoli as he was with the subject of her film, and by the end of the evening he decided he would reach out to the ITP. Ross contacted the organization via their website using CryptoCat messaging, and within weeks he and Harlan Banfield were meeting face-to-face in a Greasy Spoon diner in Chantilly, Virginia. It was Ross's idea to meet in person. He had no intention of passing intelligence off to another country, and he had to at least entertain the possibility the website and the film were all part of some elaborate false flag scheme to get American government employees to reveal secrets to the Chinese or the Russians. But by meeting with Banfield face to face, and by looking into his past history and affiliations, he satisfied himself that the project was just what it claimed to be. A clandestine clearinghouse where whistleblowers could share information in safety with journalists. During that first meeting, Banfield was on guard much the same as Ross. He had worked sources since before the man in front of him had been born. He knew better than to press this confident and intelligent NSC staffer for information. Instead, he let Ross talk about his philosophy and his desire to work in the shadows against policies he disagreed with. Banfield listened quietly and carefully, and he took note of the fact Ross had some grievances against his co-workers who did not appreciate him, and an administration that did not share his worldview or beliefs about international law. Banfield had been around the block a few times, especially with whistleblowers, and although he loved them for the product they passed, he didn't hold the individuals themselves in much regard. Ross, in Banfield's estimation, was full of grandiose ideas about diplomacy and politics. Some of them the veteran newsman actually agreed with, but as he sat there quietly in the diner listening to Ross talk, it occurred to him that if this handsome young man did someday run for political office, Banfield wouldn't vote for him. The guy was a pompous-ass narcissist. Still, Harlan Banfield said all the right things, and he told Ethan Ross he hoped they could work together to make right some of the current administration's many wrongs. There was little risk to Banfield in this endeavor. He knew no one was ever prosecuted in the United States for publishing classified data, only for leaking it. Even though Banfield would serve as a channel for the intelligence breaches and not as a publisher himself, he was a respected member of the Fourth Estate, and because of this, he knew he was safe. Ross wasn't there to entrap him, although he still might have been a government plant, and this could have been a ploy to get Banfield to reveal himself as the ITP's U.S. liaison. There was little Banfield could have done to prevent this, but if he was outed by the U.S. government, he wouldn't be arrested. He would simply pass the baton to someone else and end his formal relationship with the project. At their first meeting, Ross handed Banfield a single typewritten sheet of paper in a plastic bag. The paper wasn't an original document. It was instead a piece of classified intelligence Ross had typed himself, and the bag was to keep his fingerprints off it during transport. This first leak was small. It was his notes of a transcript of a top-secret NSA SIGINT intercept between two executives of an Israeli bank. In their conversation, they went into some detail about their practice of not lending to commercial accounts that had supported a candidate in the Labor Party. Ross provided no documentary proof this conversation ever took place, but Banfield promised to get the intelligence to the right person to have an effect. More than a month after he passed on the information, Ethan received a secure email from Banfield. Attached was a short article from that day's copy of Haaretz, an Israeli left-of-center daily, exposing the bank and its politically motivated lending practices. The executives denied the charge, but they were equivocal, obviously because they didn't know what information Haaretz had managed to uncover. Banfield followed up the link with a note. Good job. No smoking gun, but the bank is on notice, and the eyes of the world are upon them. Harlan was stroking his ego, this Ethan could plainly see, but Ethan did feel a jolt of power nevertheless, a confirmation of his ability to affect outcomes. His own disclosure had made a positive difference. Not in any great way, but he felt the risk had been minimal and very much worth the reward. The Haaretz article became a proof of concept. Ethan Ross was now an ITP whistleblower. Ross and the ITP were a perfect match. Neither was in it for any fame or notoriety, and both felt they knew better than the U.S. government what should be classified and what should be revealed to the world. His early successes as a whistleblower were impressive. He slipped Banfield information about a CIA Mossad operation to discredit an outspoken opponent of the U.S.-backed government in Jordan, and this led to harsh criticism of the policy in the world press. Next, he outed a Cayman Islands-registered enterprise that was, in actuality, a front company set up by the Mossad to pay off journalists in Latin America who ran stories promoting Israeli business interests. This revelation created a minor firestorm in Argentina as a right-of-center television station was exposed as a shill for a foreign power, and the leftist government revoked its license. For more than a year, Ethan continued in this vein with the project. Every 2 months or so, he'd either meet Banfield in person for a chat or forward something via CryptoCat. The process was going well for both parties, and although Ross remained frustrated by what he saw as his stalled career in government, he truly believed he now possessed more real power than even those with the dedicated parking spaces at the Eisenhower Building. Then Ethan learned about the U.S. involvement a few years earlier in the Israeli attack on the Turkish ship SS Ardahan, taking part in the Gaza Peace Flotilla. He had sat in on a morning meeting with some White House staffers, CIA execs, and senior military advisers. The subject was funding for political opposition parties in Lebanon, something Ethan knew quite a bit about. He was there to quietly advocate for pushing U.S. dollars to a U.N. program to educate Palestinian refugees through a Hezbollah-supported organization, but his position wasn't getting much traction. One of the CIA men made an offhand remark about the secondary benefits of direct CIA funding of some of the smaller Lebanese factions in areas where the Palestinian camps were located. A White House staffer seconded this line, adding, "We saw how beneficial it can be to have people inside the camps during the so-called Gaza Peace Flotilla attack. Beneficial for us, as well as the Mossad." Immediately, one of the CIA execs put a hand up and reminded the staffer that not everyone in the room was cleared for that code word operation. The staffer apologized sheepishly. These things happened, and the conversation moved on. Ross spent the rest of the meeting wondering what the hell the staffer was talking about. He knew nothing of any CIA involvement in the Mossad attack on the SS Ardahan, an event that dominated the news cycle for more than a week and nearly brought the Middle East to the brink of war. But he damn well planned on finding out. When he got back to his desk, it took Ethan only minutes to find the relevant data about the CIA involvement in the affair. The primary documents were located in a code word access database on Interlink TS, but Ethan was able to gain access to a brief summarizing the operation with his SCI access. The CIA had an informant on the boat. The informant had a CIA sat phone, and the CIA passed Mossad all the tactical intelligence necessary to take the ship. They did this not by giving primary access to the source via the sat phone. No, they kept their informant's identity secret from the Israelis. Instead, a CIA officer with military experience met with the Sheyatet 13 commandos on the day of the raid and gave them all the details of the armed Palestinians on the Turkish-flagged freighter. After the raid, Tel Aviv went out of its way to stress that the United States had not been involved in the operation. Ethan bought the line, and now he realized he'd been tricked. Ethan fumed. The simple knowledge that the CIA had passed the intel to the Israeli commandos before they dropped down to the boat and started shooting peace activists made him furious. He'd gone into government service to follow in his mother's footsteps and make the world a better place, not to bolster a hegemonic America by helping its shills around the globe kill peace activists. There was no turning back now. Ethan decided to act. He passed his limited and unsubstantiated information in an email to Banfield, who promised to get it to the Guardian. Ethan woke each morning to check the website of the Guardian for any news about the flotilla raid. After a week of nothing, he received a CryptoCat chat request from Banfield. The older journalist told Ethan the Guardian dismissed Ethan's tip because he'd provided nothing to substantiate such an incendiary charge. Ross was furious the British paper did not publish on his anonymous assertions alone. Banfield did what he could to calm Ethan in the chat, saying the SS Ardahan allegation had simply proved to be too much for the Guardian to swallow without proof. He then helpfully suggested that if Ethan could somehow safely get documentary evidence, then they could pass this along and get some real traction for the story. Ethan thought it over, enjoying the mental challenge of devising a plan to leak the information without getting caught. He knew if he downloaded the documents off of Interlink TS, it would leave a digital fingerprint of his doing so. As soon as the news came out about the U.S. involvement in the Ardahan attack, computer security officials at CIA would be able to track the user who accessed the information and moved it from the database portion of the network to the file-sharing portion of the network, a necessary step for items downloaded to pass through. Even if he'd just printed out the files, he'd still leave a trail. The more Ethan wrestled with the problem, the more his ego told him he had to come up with a solution. He decided to resurrect his interest in computers to try to find a way to cover his tracks to get the documents he needed. He began spending his evenings studying computer science with vigor, reading everything he could about the security of the systems on which he worked every day. At work, he pestered IT employees with made-up problems involving his logons and access, careful to adopt a constant look of confusion and bewilderment on his face, so everything they explained was explained two or even three times. He volunteered for projects that required him to have his access levels temporarily boosted so he could use the networks in the building that gave him some access, via JWix, to deeper regions of the classified CIA databases. But Ethan soon came to the realization that despite his incredible intellect, there was just too much even he did not know. The problem, as he saw it, wasn't his intelligence. Rather, it was that there existed no way for a man in his position to delve any deeper into the inner workings of computer security without raising eyebrows. Then Ross found a serendipitous answer to this problem. Her name was Eve. 11. Ethan pulled into his driveway just before 6 p.m. A light, freezing rain fell, so he held his leather folio over his head while he ran to his front door and put the key in the lock. But before he could turn the knob, the door opened suddenly. Eve Pang reached out and grabbed him by his tie and pulled him inside, and then she kissed him deeply. He shut the door behind him, and she pulled his tie off. Her lips did not unlock from his as she completed the feat, and then she pushed him up against the door and went to work on his coat. Ethan caught a quick, full-body glimpse of her in the mirror against the wall by the hallway. She had already changed from work, and now she wore one of his white pinpoint Oxfords that matched the color of both her panties and her thick wool socks. Eve pushed his overcoat off him and tried to let it fall to the floor, but he caught it behind his back and laid it on a chair by the door. She began removing his suit coat, but he fought her attempts to pull it down. Finally, she removed her mouth from his.
Is something wrong?
Tough day at work, babe. Can we talk? Surprised, she said.
Yes, of course.
Good, Ethan said, and he headed upstairs to change while Eve hung up his coat for him in the hall closet. Eve Pang was Korean-American, a senior network systems engineer for Booz Allen Hamilton, a government contractor. Ross had met her 6 months earlier, after a presentation she gave at a training conference for government employees with TS Security at her corporate offices in Tysons Corner, Virginia. He had signed up for the day-long class just to meet her. He knew she was one of the nation's top classified network administrators, and while most of the other NSC staffers in attendance couldn't wait to get out of the mind-numbingly boring training and back to D.C., Ross, on the other hand, was captivated, primarily by the classes on secure network infrastructure, and secondarily by the Asian girl with the nerdy glasses who administered a portion of the course. She was attractive, but more important, it was obvious to Ethan she possessed incredible knowledge about the architecture of the U.S. intelligence community's most classified systems, and he wanted some of that knowledge. Eve had worked on the security infrastructure of JWICS since she received her doctorate at MIT at the age of 25. Now, at 32, she was a highly paid Booz Allen systems engineer based at Fort Meade, but she worked all around the D.C. area on security protocols for the U.S. intelligence community's VPNs, or virtual private networks, remote access systems that allowed government employees to log on to some of the intelligence community's most highly classified databases from outside of the confined networks. Ethan Ross asked her out the day he met her, and she agreed with wide eyes and a thumping heart. She was flabbergasted by his advances. She'd dated only other computer geeks, and most of them had been Korean. But he was an attractive, charming, and well-groomed White House staffer who seemed as interesting as he was intelligent. Ethan knew he was using her, but he wasn't bothered by things like that, because he'd never possessed much in the way of a conscience when it came to relationships. Their early dates involved a lot of talk about work. Eve had lived computer science for her entire life. She essentially had no other hobbies apart from her work, so networks and code were the easiest topics for her to talk about. And since her new and inquisitive boyfriend possessed top-secret clearance, she did so freely. Sure, there were aspects of her job she knew she shouldn't and couldn't discuss, even with her boyfriend, but little things slipped out here and there, especially after a glass of wine, and she saw no great harm in that. They were on the same side, after all. Ethan never even gave so much as a hint to Eve that he was leaking classified information to the International Transparency Project, and he passed his computer security infrastructure questions off as both his own personal interest in computer science and a desire to ensure the NSC was safe from both outside hacks and inside breaches. Ethan liked to war game scenarios with Eve while they ate dinner or sat in front of the fireplace in her condo. She knew he was extremely intelligent, just like she was, and he possessed orders of magnitude more curiosity about her job than she did about his. It didn't hurt that he plied her with wine while they talked, and her lips loosened by the glass. But she actually found the wargaming fun and intellectually challenging. Eve fielded his questions, proud that her genius boyfriend took a real intellectual interest in her work. She joked with him on more than one occasion that even though she was an IT security professional, he was more obsessed with security than she was. One night, they sat on the sofa discussing vulnerabilities to the system, after a second bottle of claret lay empty on its side on the coffee table and a third was newly opened. Between sips from her glass, Eve explained that the weakest aspect of network security was at the default domain administrator level. The default domain administrator was the first account created on a network, and it had sweeping privileges. IT professionals often disable the DDA after setting up other users with lesser authority. But, Eve explained, in the case of Interlink TS, the CIA's top-secret network, the DDA was up and running, though the password for it was known only by a few highly placed administrators, all of whom were thoroughly vetted. Eve claimed that anyone who logged on as the DDA had virtual godlike access to all aspects of the Interlink TS. It was virtually the keys to the kingdom. An administrator with bad intent could dig around in secret corners of the system and even exfiltrate data and erase the history of the transaction. Ethan's interest was piqued, but he needed more information. Wow. Those people given that logon must be very reliable. Eve smiled and winked with an eye already half-masked from drink. I have it. You don't. Her smile widened. I do. And with it, you can go anywhere and no one would know? If I wanted to. I never have. Why should I? Ethan still found this all hard to believe. There is an audit trail for everything we do. Madeline Crossman, the security compliance officer in my department, is always checking on us via audits to make sure we don't try to pull unauthorized access. Eve replied, "There is no audit for the DDA that I can't get around, which means when I'm logged on as the DDA, there is no audit for me." She giggled. Ethan, at my level, I am the audit. So your password makes you untouchable? Not exactly untouchable. I work with the virtual private networks that access Interlink TS via the JWIX, and this requires two-factor authentication. She walked over to her purse and pulled out two small identical fobs the size of keychains with LCD screens on them. On the screens were a half-dozen numbers. One of the devices had a red tag on it that said PANG, and the other said PANG DDA. I use these. I can access the CIA's network via my laptop by putting in my logon and then adding the number on the screen, which changes every 30 seconds. But if I wanted to log on as the DDA, I would do the same thing and use this fob. These fobs and the numbers on them track back to me. Before Ethan's eyes, the six numbers on each device changed to six new numbers. Ethan looked at the fobs closely. But you are saying someone who isn't logging in remotely, like someone inside CIA or somewhere with direct access to the network, wouldn't need these things. Exactly right. Someone on the network itself only needs the DDA logon, and then they can do whatever the hell they want. I've written papers about it. It's a real vulnerability, but no one listens. She laughed, dropped the fobs back in her purse, and reached for her wine glass. The best IT people in the business aren't working for the government, and we contractors are given a lot of access power, but not a lot of decision-making authority. Ethan mumbled to himself.
Incredible. You're almost untouchable.
She reached out, took Ethan's hand, and slipped it under her button-down Oxford shirt. She placed his hand on her small breast.
I am touchable. See.
But with my password and my fob,
you are the only one who can touch me.
She laughed at her joke, and in her laugh Ethan could tell just how inebriated she was. He decided to push his luck. Don't you ever worry you'll forget your password? She shook her head.
My password? No, because I use it every day.
But I only use the DDA credentials every few months, so I have it written down.
What? That's not smart, Eve. Even I know that.
She kissed him.
Don't worry. I'll show you.
She left the room for a moment, and Ethan sat there, gobsmacked.
No one in IT handed over their password, even drunk, lonely girls trying to impress their boyfriends.
He scrambled to refill her wine glass. When she returned, she opened a single sheet of paper. He tried not to snatch it out of her hands because he knew its importance to his mission. But when he saw it, he realized he didn't have the keys to the kingdom he thought he did. It was a page full of handwritten characters that looked like Asian script of some sort.
It's in Korean? Ethan said.
That's not exactly secure, babe.
It's not Korean. It's Edu, a 1,000-year-old script that was used in Korea. Not many people can write it. But the best part is, it looks like traditional Chinese. Like Kaishu, which was around at the same time. If someone tries to translate the words and numbers here, they will get it wrong, because they will think it is traditional Chinese. Edu is forgotten.
Ethan was impressed, and he told his girlfriend so. She beamed, she swooned, and 10 minutes later, she passed out. Ethan photographed the page of chicken scratches with his phone. While Eve slept, Ethan spent the rest of the night congratulating himself on his incredible intellect and social engineering skills, and wondering how the hell he was going to translate characters from Edu. Ethan found a translator after some internet searching, a professor of ancient East Asian languages at the University of Chicago. The professor did it for free. It took him just minutes to email back a 14-character series of letters and numbers. Ethan then used the DDA access credentials to log in on a JWIX terminal in the NSC's Secure Administration Wing. He found the docs on the SCI codeword access flotilla operation. He didn't read every page of every document himself. That would have taken hours, and he had only minutes. He pilfered the files using the techniques Eve had outlined to him over dinner and sent the files to Harlan Banfield. Banfield looked them over, then told him they would sit on them until they knew the breach had gone undetected, perhaps as long as 6 months. Ethan was impatient. He was certain he'd executed the breach perfectly, but Banfield insisted the ITP would nevertheless use its own tried-and-true security protocols. And then, nothing. For 4 months, he'd seen nothing in the news on the flotilla raid. He'd held off pilfering more documents from JWIX because he wanted to see how the Guardian exploited this first batch. But the fact that Banfield and his group hadn't even sent the files on to the media infuriated him. And now this. The FBI running around the NSC, claiming a data breach and alleging the breach got some ex-Israeli commando and his family killed. Something went wrong with his exfiltration of the data. He'd managed to obfuscate his involvement. He'd logged in as a DDA, so they couldn't have known it was him, after all. But somehow, they had still noticed the transfer into the file-sharing location. Tonight, Ethan and Eve sat at his house, not hers, but they drank claret and talked about network intrusions, much like that evening 4 months ago. Eve knew all about the NSC breach. Even though it didn't involve her or one of her virtual private networks, she would have been briefed on it first thing this morning. Ethan talked about the meeting with the FBI man the day before, and the possibility there was some sort of a mole at NSC, but this was all just to set up his line of inquiry, because he desperately wanted to know what went wrong. He didn't think for a second he had made a mistake himself. No, he was certain Eve Pang had screwed up in her explanation of the DDA logon's omniscience over the network. This angered him, but he wouldn't let it show. Between sips of wine and while gently stroking Eve's hair as they sat facing each other on his couch, he asked, "What do you think happened?"
"I know exactly what happened."
This surprised Ross. "You do?"
"Yes.
The government IT hacks are fools. They let the intrusion happen, but then they got lucky. It was nothing more than that." Ethan forced himself to take a sip of his wine. His fingers wanted to crush the glass in his hand, but he forced an air of calm. "How did they get lucky?" Eve smiled. "A spot audit for anomalous behavior was done on the network. This happens less than 5% of the time. Even then, the audit records were never reviewed. They were just stored automatically on the server. It picked up the files being moved to the file-sharing server in the National Security Council office."
"I see," said Ethan.
"Can they tell if the files were downloaded or printed?"
"Most likely downloaded.
The printers themselves would have recorded the job if they were used. I assume even the government IT security people are competent enough to check that out." She added, "Someone should have begun investigating this 4 months ago. Instead, it wasn't until the thing happened in India when the system administrators at Langley were asked to review the files on Interlink TS to make sure they were secure." Now, she laughed out loud. "They must have pulled up the logs and shouted, 'Aw, shit,' when they saw they were accessed and exfiltrated." Then she added, almost as an aside, "They'll never find out who did it."
"Why not?"
"Do you remember that night when I told you about domain administrator access?" Ethan looked off into space for a long moment.
"Vaguely."
"I'd bet anything someone logged on as a DDA to do it. I can't prove it. That's the problem with DDA credentials, but that's what I think happened. They'll never know who broke in that way, so they might as well give up looking."
"How about that?" Ethan said.
He wanted to put his hand through the wall. Just as he'd expected, he'd done everything exactly right. It had only been a stroke of very bad luck. His intrusion likely never would have been noticed if not for the completely coincidental death of the Israeli in India. Eve tried to make another move on Ethan, but he wasn't in the mood. She went to bed early, and he sat in his living room with a glass of wine in his hand, staring at a movie on TV that he didn't give a damn about. His entire focus now was on beating the polygraph. If he did that, he'd be fine. He told himself there wasn't a single FBI agent in the world who could outsmart him. The investigation would fizzle out, or else that bitch Beth Morris at the Western Hemisphere desk would be suspected of the breach. The only thing left for him to do was ace the box.
12. Dominic Caruso stood at his stove, stirring diced tomatoes into a saucepan full of fat shrimp, olive oil, and herbs. The smell of garlic and oregano was prevalent, and the crushed red pepper made his eyes water. The heat from the stove created a thin sheen of sweat on his forehead, which he blotted away with the towel on his shoulder. When his forehead was dry again, he left the towel on his shoulder, keeping it at the ready. This was shrimp fra diavolo, after all. He'd really start sweating only when he ate it. Dom had always loved to cook. When he was young, it brought him closer to his mom and grandmother, and now it brought him back to his childhood. And with that came some happy thoughts. And that was the plan this evening. He wasn't cooking because he was hungry. Tonight he thought it might be a good idea to do something productive to occupy his mind for a couple hours. So he'd climbed off the couch, ignoring his bruised ribs and his slight headache while he struggled to get his coat on, and then he ventured out for groceries. Fixing a real dinner wasn't much, but it beat ordering a pizza, and it beat sitting in his dark condo and brooding. Dom turned down the heat on the saucepan and stepped away for a moment to open a bottle of Trebbiano he'd found tucked in the back of his refrigerator. He swigged right out of the bottle while he went back to the stove, then splashed a little into the Fra Diavolo and ducked the steam that roared up out of the bubbling dish. While he cooked, his mind drifted, thinking of the last meal he'd prepared here in his place. It had been the evening before his flight to India, and unlike tonight, he had not been alone, because Dom did not, as a rule, cook for one. Her name was Abby. She was a bartender at an upscale saloon in Georgetown. He'd been a regular at her bar, though he was quiet and preferred sitting in the dark to interacting with her other regulars. One night he stayed till closing, and the two of them then went to a local late-night watering hole for a nightcap. They sat talking for an hour over beers. He'd told her he was in corporate security, and other than cool, she'd made no comment about his job again. They'd made love at her place first, but after a couple more nights of meeting for drinks before the inevitable late-night hookup, Dom asked her over to his condo for a home-cooked meal. He prepared an authentic veal and ricotta meatball dish and served it by candlelight with one of his favorite Chianti Classicos. She seemed pleasantly surprised he could actually cook, but she hadn't come over for the veal. So soon after their plates were stacked in the sink and the bottle of Chianti was empty on the coffee table, Dom and Abby disappeared into his dark bedroom, and the meal was all but forgotten. Dom enjoyed that last night before India, but he'd barely thought of Abby at all during his trip, and she hadn't emailed or called once while he was gone. So that was that. Dom decided he'd have to avoid her bar for a while, so they could both move on. Dom plated his dinner and headed into the living room, grabbing the Trebbiano along the way. In stark contrast to the candlelit dinner with Abby, tonight he sat alone on his couch with his feet up on the coffee table. The TV was tuned to a poker tournament, but he wasn't paying attention to it. He sipped his wine and ate his shrimp and sulked. He was proud of tonight's dinner. It had the right balance of flavors, the buttery sweetness of the shrimp, the heat of the red pepper, and the zing of the citrus. But he was in a dark mood, partly because he didn't have a woman here to eat it with him and fawn over it before he could take her to his bed. Dom was Italian, after all. He was well aware of the seductive power of food. His mind drifted off the food, off the women, and he thought of the Jacobis and the meals they'd shared, and he thought of the kids, and he thought about the American son of a bitch who sold them out to the terrorists, as if their lives meant nothing. This train of thought brought him yet again to his own responsibility in their deaths. Try as he might to remain objective about his actions, he continued to second-guess himself for being unable to save them. Dom wrestled with the images in his mind throughout dinner. When his plate and his bottle were both empty, he considered checking his refrigerator again to see if there was another cold bottle of Trebbiano tucked in there somewhere. He thought he might try to watch TV and drain another bottle before bed. No, he couldn't sit here all night drinking alone and thinking dangerous thoughts. He looked at his watch. 10:30 p.m. He came up with a new plan for the evening. and instantly his mind drifted away from the Jacobis. He knew it was temporary, just like cooking the Fra Diavolo for one had been. But it beat sitting here brooding. Don't do it, Dom. He didn't know why he talked to himself like that. He knew he was going to do it. His body ignored his inner voice. He stood, went into his bedroom and changed into a pair of jeans and a brown leather jacket. Slipping his left arm in the sleeve felt like someone was twisting one of his ribs with a pair of pliers, but he fought through the pain and got it done. Before walking out his front door, he took 5 minutes to straighten his place, because even though he wasn't sure where he was going, and he had no idea who he would meet there, he had no intentions of returning alone. By 11 p.m., Caruso sat on a bar stool at a 14th Street gastropub called The Pig. He'd been here a dozen times in the past, each time looking for food, drink, and perhaps something more. As he sipped his beer, he scanned the dark and lively establishment, his eyes tracking over dozens of tables, each one with a cluster of patrons enjoying themselves. And Dom identified several potential targets. This always felt to Dom a little like the fixed position surveillance ops he did with the campus, except he wasn't tailing terrorists or Russian mobsters or keeping an eye out for enemy counter-surveillance. No, he was here to pick up a girl. Dom's phone contact list was crammed with other hookup opportunities, but they all would entail a certain amount of familiar conversation that would involve, inevitably, a high level of compassion and concern. Dom was rough and ragged, mentally and physically, and all of his female friends, even the most peripheral, would attempt to mother him, trying to find out what on earth was wrong. Dom wasn't looking to be mothered tonight. He didn't notice the woman just down the bar on his first examination of the room, but that wasn't because she was unattractive. On the contrary, she was a striking brunette, his age to a few years older, with almond eyes and full lips. He hadn't noticed her at first because she was surrounded by three young and very large men. One sat on either side of her at the bar, and the third stood close behind her. One of the men laughed loudly and put his arm around her, while the other two drank whiskey out of rocks glasses and glanced around the room with sly grins on their faces. Dom's eyes moved on. His radar scanned for targets of opportunity, after all, and this particular potential target was lost in the signal interference of testosterone. He finished his beer and ordered another. A redhead sitting with a friend at a two-top near the back wall caught his eye, and he hers. Dom scanned for a wedding ring on her ring finger like a seasoned pro, and saw her finger was unadorned. But then he noticed the woman's dramatic mannerisms in her conversation with her friend, and her ragged fingernails were evident even from halfway across the room. He pegged her as more frazzled and emotional than he was prepared to deal with at the moment, and he resumed his scrutiny of the room. A tall, athletic blonde in a business suit glanced his way through a large group of both male and female co-workers, but her dress and the gang around her told him she worked on the Hill. Dom knew a few congressional staff members. He had nothing against them, personally, but he wasn't really in the mood to listen to either inane party politics or cynical gossip from the congressional cloakroom, so he moved on, continuing his slow study of eligible women in the pub. Dom sighed inwardly while he searched. The older he got, and the better he became at reading people, the tougher it was to find someone he was compatible with. He wondered whether or not he really wanted to ever get married, since he found it so damn hard to connect with someone mentally even for a single night. After another long pull of his beer, Dom recognized the real impediment to a connection was his own frame of mind. India had fucked him up, even for something as callous and momentary as sleeping around. Come on, D. Soldier on. He ordered his third drink of the evening, and when it arrived, he thought about making his way toward a table of three good-looking college-aged women in the middle of the dining room. But his plan was derailed when he heard the beautiful brunette just down the bar from him raise her voice in annoyance